Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. At this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron's an award-winning author based in South Carolina. He's the author of 31 books, including Sergeant Smack, The Lives and Times of Ike Atkinson, Kingpin and His Band of Brothers, and the just-published Straight from the Hood, Amazing but True Gangster Tales. He's also the producer of two award-winning documentaries. Get out there and buy these books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed. Ron is also a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland documentary series and publisher of Strategic Media Books. You can go to www.strategicmediabooks.com. Be sure to visit his website at www.ronchepsik.com. I'll spell you his last name. It's a bit of a tongue twister, C-H-E-P-E-S-I-U-K. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Also, I'd just like to mention, Ron is a two-time Fulbright Scholar recipient, and he's all over the place, this guy. He represented the United States in Bangladesh and Indonesia. Now, here is Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and here's a little bio on my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. This year, he'll be publishing a book, Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about the influential people from the Thunder Bay area, which happens to be my hometown, and early next year, a book about the famous Ganelda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie.
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. You always do a great promo. And by the way, Movers and Mavericks is coming out on the 15th of December, and we're getting a lot of requests for the book already. And thanks for being a part of it, Ronnie. You've got two great chapters in it. Well, Ronnie, I'll tell you, we've got a great, great show tonight. We've got a triple whammy. We've got Mr. Larry Mazza, Tommy Dades, and Bob Mladenich. The triple whammy is a first for us, where we'll discuss and expose details of the visceral and deadly Colombo Mafia Wars of the early 1990s. Mazza was a hitman, believe it or not, during that period. Dades was a detective, and Mladenich, also a cop-turned-journalist, is writing a very extraordinary book about this visceral time in crime history. It's going to be a great show, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Well, Ronnie, just before we reach into our mailbag and read some mail we received over the past week, we're thrilled and really delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and thumbs up about our program around the world. That's around the world. This certainly is something to cheer about and wave the flag about, buddy. I'd like to thank all our production people at Artists First World Radio Network for making this possible, in particular Tony, Scott, and Corey for making the show possible. Like I said before, Ronnie Boy, Internet radio is here to is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Now, here is this week's mailbag. Hey, Ronnie, this one is from Dante from all the way in Rome, Italy, who writes, I listened to your show last week with Benjamin Runkel. I tend to agree with Will Hareb's statement that this is vigilante justice and has no room as a legitimate military tactic. Even though these terrorists want to do harm on other people, there's no excuse for governments to take the law into their own hands. What next? The preemptive strike on the Pope for alleged sex crimes? Hey, Ronnie, any comments on that?
Well, I'll tell you something. This guy's a real Italian wise guy, no pun intended. I mean, come on. That strikes on the Pope for alleged sex crimes. He's really, stretching the argument there, but it is kind of funny. one of my funnier comments and wittier ones. But well, yeah, you know, we disagreed on this. You know, I didn't mind. You know, Noriega was one thing. I mean, Noriega was revenge. But we talk about Osama bin Laden. I have no qualms about killing the scumbag, you know, and getting him off the scene. And I don't think international law would have helped at all. You know, he'd still be around. I don't think Pakistan would have given help or Afghanistan. So I have no qualms. So I think it's a mixed bag. It's not cut and dry like some of our guests believe, but we appreciate their comments.
Well, absolutely. He's got something to say, Dante. And Dante, keep on listening to our shows. We welcome your comments. Now, here's this one from Sarah of Colorado, who writes, "Your show with Ben Runkle, author of Wanted, Dead or Alive, is an eye-opener. Granted, the number one priority for the United States is to maintain a safe environment for the citizens of our country, free of terrorists, threats, but not illegally. The behavior of the United States government with preemptive strikes is tyranny, and I don't want any part of it. I've got a good mind to burn my Social Security card and move to Canada where I can live knowing I'm not part of the killing machine." Hey, Ronnie, pretty strong words there from Sarah.
It's a really a sensitive listener. I mean, you know, you go to Canada in protest the Vietnam War, not to deal with something like this. But, you know, again, it's something that, you know, it's a mixed bag. And I thought Ben Runkle, you know, really had some interesting information. He explained the strategic objectives of manhunts, you know, from a military point of view. And it was a real interesting program. And we got to respect our guests' opinions. But,
absolutely.
And, of course, there's going to be disagreement with something as controversial as this.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Sarah was among over 100,000 listeners last week listening to
right.
Mr. Runkle. Anyway, thanks for that, Sarah. Hey, Ronnie, listen, you know, we've got a great, great lineup, and give us an idea what's in store for us in that wide expanse of cyberspace for next week's show and the other shows. And tell us what you've been up to.
Right. Well, this next week we have another interesting show, and we go from the Cosa Nostra this week to art theft and literary theft, and we have two guests, Tom Marbury and Anthony Amore, talking about stealing Rembrandts, and we have another guest, Eric Rasmussen, a professor from Nebraska, talking about Shakespeare folios, and they've got some really wild stories about how these works of art and precious objects were stolen, you know, over time. So it's going to be another interesting show. And like I said, we like variety is the spice of life, and you find it on Crime Beat.
You bet. You bet. I'm
right. Listening. And as far as we're doing, I got back from 4 days. I was in Durham, North Carolina.
Yeah, that's
up the
right.
Research, finishing up the research for the documentary we're working on the biggest mystery in the history of organized crime, without a doubt, whatever happened to Frank Matthews, one of the two or three biggest drug traffickers in U.S. history. And we're planning on that to come out in January, and we're moving towards another step in the Sergeant Smack project. I mentioned in one of our earlier broadcasts that book was optioned for a movie, and so we'll have some news to announce in the new year that project. Willie?
Yeah, Ronnie, that's an intriguing story. Frank Matthews, he's disappeared in thin air. And
almost 40 years. You know, he talked about Woody Bossier. Woody Bossier was only gone for 16,
yeah.
And you know, and Woody Bossier was essentially a small thug in a big
That's
city,
right.
whereas Frank
yeah.
Matthews was an international drug dealer.
Absolutely, looking forward to your book there and everything that comes out of it. And good luck on that side. Well, Ronnie Boyd, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Here is this week's rap sheet item number one. Dateline, December 2nd, Fort Myers, Florida. Mother who took porn shots of own kids gets 25 years. Hey, Ronnie, a woman by the name of Candace Miller admittedly sexually assaulted her children and emailed pictures of the sex acts to a Michigan man. The Florida woman admitted to taking photos of sex acts with her son and daughter and was sentenced to 25 years in prison. Hey, Ronnie, we have a new low in criminal activity, especially these type of hyenas, sex crimes.
Man,
what's your thoughts on this?
I don't know if we could top this for a low. This woman, believe it or not, claimed that some man in a chat room convinced her that by having sex with her children, she could improve her relationship with them, believe that or not. And that's the story she's trying to sell. And she claimed that he had a doctorate in psychology.
Yeah.
And you know, there was no further... reports on, you know, whether, you know, the police were going to investigate us or not. But it's the good news is the investigation was part of a Project Safe Childhood, which was launched in 2006 to combat the growing epidemic of child sexual exploitation and abuse. And we hope to have a guest on for one of these groups to talk about the problem.
Yeah. Well,
in,
you know,
in that new year.
Yeah, that 25 years is well-deserved.
I thought it was kind of light, right?
Well, she should have got more than that, I would say. Anyway, we'll keep an eye on this extraordinary story. It's just not going to go away, these type of things. Anyway, here's rap sheet item number 2. Dateline, December the 7th, Chicago, Illinois. Former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich sentenced to 14 years in federal prison. Hey, Ronnie. Blagojevich, a Democrat, was accused of trying to profit as he considered whom to appoint to succeed President Barack Obama, or he was a senator at the time. That's when he vacated his Senate seat to move to the White House. The former Illinois governor was convicted of corruption in June after a jury returned 17 guilty verdicts against him. Hey, Ronnie, this guy's going to have a long time to figure out what went wrong, buddy. Any comments?
Yeah, I tell you, you know, this is the third governor who's been accused of corruption in recent times, and they're going to have to start reading the Miranda rights, you know, to the governors when they come in. They'll have their hand on the Bible, and they'll be taking their fingerprints, you know, with the other hand. And,
yeah.
You know, I heard somebody talking about Blago's hair. What's going to happen to Blago's hair in prison? Maybe we could ask Larry Mazza, who's in prison, one of our guests on today. But one of my gangster friends, you know, who served time in prison, he said he's got more to worry about. He's going to go in as a baritone, come out as a soprano.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. Well, he's going to get a buzz cut for sure, guaranteed.
Yeah, right on that. But you know, he's going to be 67 when he gets out,
yeah.
And just, you know, completely destroyed his life. A lot of it's his fault. He was a clown. You know, he's on a reality show. He taunted the judicial system. So, surprisingly, a lot of people on these talk shows this morning, I was listening to them, were saying it was too much, 14 years, you know.
Yeah.
He tried to sell a seat. I mean, God, 14 years. People are given 14 years for marijuana possession today.
Yeah, so, well, that's what you get when you're chummy with Donald Trump, for sure.
Yeah, the battle of the hairstyles, right?
Okay, we're going to go with another rap sheet item this evening. Rap sheet item number 3, Dateline, December the 3rd. New York City, 85-year-old woman strip-searched at JFK Airport. Hey, Ronnie, an elderly New York City woman says she's planning to sue the Transportation Security Administration after what she said was a humiliating strip search. An 85-year-old New York grandmother said Saturday she was injured and humiliated when she was strip-searched at the airport after she asked to be patted down instead of going through a body scanner. Did you know, Ronnie, I tell you, this is pretty sad stuff. This takes the cake.
Well,
what's up with this?
You know, I don't fly anymore unless I have to. You know, if I could swim the Atlantic Ocean to go to Europe, I would.
Yeah.
I can't do that. You know, I drive everywhere I can. Sort of like John Madden. Remember John Madden used to have that special van? And,
that's right.
Yeah, that's what I feel today. And on that. But, you know, they claimed he never strip searched her, but there was no private screening recorded. I mean, you believe that? I mean, they don't have any private screenings. That shows you how arrogant they are because they know something's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, like an 85-year-old woman's going to come through with a defibrillator and, you know, maybe panic or say something. And it was really strange, but it also lasted 11 minutes. I mean, you know, 11 minutes.
But she missed her flight too, man.
Yeah, she missed her flight. She scraped her knee, and she was on bone-thinning medication. And she claims there was an emergency medical technician patched her up, but the hospital denied that there was any medical personnel there. So this looks like I'm making of an interesting lawsuit, right?
Absolutely. You know, it's gonna give a lot of elderly out there who fly a lot. They're gonna say, "Hey, I'm not gonna be flying anymore."
Yeah.
It's
well,
gonna
you,
hurt
you,
the
right.
The
you know, when you watch those old Nazi war films in the 1940s, you know, think of the Gestapo. You know, we got one here in the United States, as far as I'm concerned, at TSA.
Pretty sad. It's pretty sad. Well, we'll keep an eye on that story. Before we get on to our very special guest, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have a question for our guests, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you and try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie Boy, tonight's very special guests are Mr. Larry Mazza, Mr. Tommy Dades, and Mr. Bob Mladenich. They'll talk about the deadly Colombo Mafia Wars of the late 1980s and early 1990s. Mazza was a hitman during that period, Dade's a detective, and Mladenich, a cop turned writer who is writing a book about this deadly period. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Hey, thank you, Ron. Great to be here.
Great. We're really looking forward to the show. And we'll be talking about the Colombia Mafia War, which, according to what I read, is approximately from 1989 to about 1992. And maybe we'll start off and find out how you three gentlemen got together. And I'm going to direct this question to Bob Mladenich. Bob?
Well, myself and Tommy Dades were working as detectives in Brooklyn South when suddenly bodies started dropping all over the streets over the course of a couple of months. And we had a lot of intelligence about what was happening, but there was a lot of stuff we didn't know. And what we didn't know was that there was an internecine warfare between these dueling leaders in the organization, and it resulted in quite a big body count on the street.
Right. Right. This is very interesting. And Tommy and Larry, I understand that you guys go back in terms of history, right?
Yeah, a long way.
Right. How about Tommy? How about you explain how that connection goes?
Well, we both have a history and a background in boxing. Larry Moore in kickboxing, and there used to be a gym in Brooklyn on Avenue U, and they had a ring set up in the back, and we were teenagers, and we would bump into each other in there occasionally. And, from there, we start seeing each other in different clubs and different bars. And, people in Brooklyn South, it's a very small world, and it's not hard to make friends with people from all walks of life.
Right. And Larry, I understand that yes. you and Tommy went different ways. I mean, you both essentially started out in the same direction, but you fell into a life of crime and violence after enrolling at John Jay College, right? And you wanted to become a cop or firefighter. Explain what happened there.
Well, earlier than that, while I was graduating high school, I had a job in a supermarket where I did deliveries and different things for the supermarket. And while I was going to John Jay, I was still going to Beth Beach bodybuilding. That's where Tommy mentioned. But let me mention, we go back a little further, even younger, when we were in kickboxing together in karate. That's when I first met him. And we actually sparred together. I'll let him tell you a little about that.
Right.
But then I was delivering these groceries. I met a woman named Linda. And
Shiro, right?
Linda Shiro. We wound up having an affair, and it sort of totally threw my whole life in a different direction, from going to college to be, like you said, a cop or even an FBI agent or whatever. I wound up spending a lot of time with her, meeting her husband, who was Greg Scarpa, a notorious mob guy, as bad as any you'll ever know, Al Capone, or even worse than him. And I wound up, as time went on, becoming his right-hand man, and it just was a snowball effect, if you ever saw one.
Right. Just for our listeners, Scarpa was a real scary guy. He was called the Grim Reaper. And
yep.
I know there was a story about Mary Barry, right? The beautiful mob holder. Right.
Yeah.
Can you explain, just to give the audience a sense of what you were playing with? You were playing with the wife of this mobster who was just a cold stone killer.
Right.
Could you explain that story?
Well, you got to realize Barry. When I was younger, I didn't realize who he was, and as time went on, I started understanding. And the Mary Barry thing is, it was a situation where she was the girlfriend of someone very close to Greg, who was a high-ranking official in our family, Persico. And I don't know if it was a fact or not, but they assumed or surmised that she was going to become a witness for the government and tell them the whereabouts of the guy that was hiding, Alley Boy. So they decided they had to hit her. And with the whole family, who do they go to? They go to Greg. because it's not, you know, often that women get killed in life. So they went to him, and he set the thing up, brought it to a local bar that he had a piece of, and I remember him telling me that he wouldn't let anybody else do it because he didn't think they had the stomach for it. And for the most part, he was right. But he told me how he shot her, and then he just took her out, and he dumped her body not too far from his own house. You know, and
wow.
Yeah, most of the guys, like I said, didn't have the stomach for it, so that showed you the difference. And he used that for his to his advantage. Always make us fear or respect, or whatever word you want to use. But we had whatever we had that respect for him and fear for him.
Wow.
Those things like
Wow. Well, you were like a teenage boy. You were like age 17 when you met Linda
right.
Shiro,
yep.
Greg Scarpa's. Was she his wife or his girlfriend?
Well, it was, I guess later on I found out, a common law wife. I don't know that they ever got married for real because he was married to someone else who lived in New Jersey. He had a regular family life there. And he was gone a lot. And in those nights, I was spending with Linda.
Right. Well, you were just a teenage boy. I mean, young, 17, mm-hmm. and she was 15 years, reportedly 15 years older
right.
than you. And you know, it's kind of hard for a hot young guy to keep someone like that quiet, right? You're hanging around increasingly with this really scary mobster. I mean, how did you manage to keep that affair a secret?
Well,
you know, without the big boss finding out.
For a while, we did. You know, we had, like I said, he had time that he was away, and we kept it quiet. But as I got closer to Greg, I guess Greg and Linda both saw that I was getting very uneasy about the whole
right.
thing, because as I became his friend, it became more and more wrong in my eyes. When it first started, I was a young kid, and hey, I mean, I don't think many kids would have not did what I did, because she was a good-looking
right.
woman, I mean, really.
Right.
So, but as I got closer to him, I started really feeling guilty, and they both saw it in me. And ultimately, that led to her somewhere along the way telling him, and believe it or not, he okayed it and actually had a sit-down with me where we discussed how this could continue.
Wow, were you scared?
Oh, I was terrified. I'll tell you exactly how I felt. If you know the movie The Godfather,
right.
That is the best way I could describe it, because I always had it in my head. If he ever asked me or ever confronted me about me and Linda, I would deny it, because I knew that if I answered the wrong way, I would be killed.
Right.
And there was this closet door in our club, and I've heard many stories that if you didn't give the right answers, somebody was in that closet waiting to come out with a gun, and you were whacked. You were dead. So I always had that in my head, and I said I would never, never admit it. But
wow.
Greg had a way. I don't know. He had a way of just sort of easing you, and whatever it was, when he confronted me with this, somehow or another, I believed it. Although I was terrified and thinking somebody was in that closet, it was the moment of truth for me. And I had to answer him a certain way, and I did.
Wow, and lucky for you, right?
Well,
excuse me. Go ahead, Larry.
Well, would he let? He was actually telling me that he knew about me and Linda, and
right.
putting me to the test. And in the back of my head, I'm saying, deny it, deny it, deny it. But somewhere else in the recesses of my mind, I turned around and I told him, I'll never forget it. I says, Greg, I have a lot of respect for you. I know you're a smart guy. You're far from an idiot. But only an idiot wouldn't see what was going on.
Wow.
And he just busted out laughing. He got around the desk. He hugged me. And then he explained to me how it could go on and not to worry about it. It's our secret. And whatever Linda wants, she gets. And, you know, on and on. But it's pretty crazy.
Right. Bob, you write in the prologue you sent me, which I found really interesting. It's a taste of the book that's going to be written about. You said that Scarpa was quite possibly the most dangerous man in New York. And of course, we just saw a microcosm of this guy. What was, why was he so dangerous, individual, and in your opinion, possibly the most dangerous man in New York City?
Greg Scarpa, you know, just as his nickname denotes, the Grim Reaper, he had even the most scary hitmen were afraid of him. He was smart enough to not want to be the big boss, and that way he was probably off the radar, although there's a whole other story about him really not being off the radar, even though a lot of people thought he did. But he was able to sort of act as his own agent. And he loved murder. He literally had a bloodlust. And as Larry can attest, Tommy can attest, he loved to kill people. He loved to talk about it. He once told his daughter that he killed somebody that had tried to molest her, and it was like a moment of revelry at a dinner table.
Right.
So he lived to. He loved money and he loved killing, and it's unknown what order those two loves were.
Tommy, during this period when Larry was moving into the mob and he was establishing his relationship with Scarpa and all that, you must have known what was going on, right? About what was happening with, and he was your friend too. What were your thoughts and
well, back in those days, it was me who Larry's parents didn't want around. we kind of did a crossroads. So back at that period of time, didn't look like I was heading to be a cop, and that just happened by accident, And that's when I started to straighten my act out. And I mean, I didn't have anything against Larry. A lot of guys I grew up with, went different ways.
Right.
That was just the way, just the way of the neighborhood, and
right.
you can see why, I could see why some, people would go that route, thank God I caught myself at the right time and didn't.
Right. Yeah, it's really amazing because we had Louis Diaz on. Do you know who Louis Diaz is? He was a DEA agent and he wrote a book called Dancing with the Devil and he brought down Nicky Barnes.
I've heard of him.
He told us exactly the same thing, and when you hear his life story, he could have gone either way, and he talks about, seeing a guy get killed by the mob in his neighborhood and all that. So that's, that's really true. And unfortunately for Larry, he made the wrong turn on that. But before we continue,
when Larry was hanging out with Greg, I was hanging out in Tally's bar with Sammy the Bull.
Sammy the Bull.
So I was nobody
and
to talk.
And then I did time with Nicky Barnes.
Geez, we gotta have you guys back on the show. Anything we don't cover in the new year again, we can talk about that later. But let's take a station break and continue. We're gonna move into a little bit about the how the war started and what you guys, Tommy and Larry were doing there, and we'll talk to you about what kind of resume you need to have to be a hitman, Larry. On that day. So go ahead, Willie.
You bet, Ronnie. What a fascinating trio we've got tonight. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Hrib. Now back with Ron, Larry Mazza, Tommy Dades, and Bob Mladenich to talk about the Colombo Mafia Wars that took place almost two decades ago. Take it away, Ronnie.
Right. And before we continue, we have some authors in our own right. Bob Mladenich has done three books. I'll let him list them, and he could tell you a little bit about where you can find more information about them. And Tommy Dades has done a great book on another subject, which deserves a program in itself, and I'll let him talk about where our listeners can get copies of those books and more information about our fascinating guests. Go ahead, Bob.
My first book, Ron, was called From the Mouth of the Monster, the Joel Rifkin Story, and it chronicled my college friendship with a fellow by the name of Joel Rifkin, who later on, 20 years after I knew him, became the most prolific serial killer in New York State history. He killed 17 prostitutes that we know of. There might be more. My second book is called Lethal Embrace. It's about a murder for hire that went terribly wrong on Long Island at a Dolphin Fitness Club. And the third book is called Hooked Up for Murder, which is about a clean-cut college student who somehow winds up in Brooklyn. Brooklyn keeps popping up and is a recurring theme tonight, but he winds up in a very bad neighborhood with some very bad kids and finds himself, he winds up getting killed.
Right. That's really fascinating. And so it's available everywhere, right? On Amazon, bookstores.
The books are available Amazon, Kindle. You can get them on the you can wire them, you know, Kindle them now and all that stuff.
Right. And how about you, Tommy?
Well, we had one book that was written about our team called Mob Over Miami, written by Michelle McPhee, who's now a criminal journalist in Boston.
Right.
That was about the Chris Paciello story. And then we, me and Mike Vecchione, the chief of the Rackets Bureau in the Brooklyn DA's office, wrote a book with the author David Fisher about the two mob cops, Louis Eppolito and Steve Caracappa.
Right.
And that book came out about a year and a half ago, and they're both still available, you know, through via computer.
Right. Well, that sounds great. And let's continue with our show, and let's get a little background on the Colombo Mafia, or maybe explain, Bob, who the Colombo family is, and then Tommy Larry could, you know, fill in some of the details of how this war got started. Go ahead, Bob.
The Colombo family is one of the five mob families in New York. There's the Bonanos, the Genovese, the Lucchese's, and others. And there was the leader of the Colombo family, Alfonso Persico, was jailed, and he put the family in charge of his son. Or actually, he put it in charge of a guy named Vicarina until Persico's son got out of jail. And when Persico's son got out of jail, Vicarina liked being the boss so much, he didn't want to give it up. And all of the members of the family were pretty much forced to take sides and have this internal civil war.
Right. And Larry, how did you get involved in this?
Well, you know, that's a good brief summary, but there's a lot more, a whole bunch
right.
more.
And we only get an hour, which seems like eternity, but...
I know.
Go ahead, please.
We don't have time for me to tell you all the treachery and all the backstabbing that was going on, but it's true. It was Carmine the Steak Persico. That was the father who had the family, and he did appoint Vic. And Vic was misled by a lot of other people. He was misled by John Gotti, Joe Scopo, lots of heavyweights to try to take over the family officially. But there was a faction, which was later called the Persico faction, which I was on, that opposed that. We were going to stand behind Junior Persico. He was doing life for this family, and
right.
we weren't going to allow somebody else to take it over. And I didn't know all this, but this is what I was told, and I thought we were on the right side, and I did what was right, and we fought the arena side. But there was a lot more. I mean, a ton of backstabbing and, like I said before, treachery. I could go on and on for 4 hours
right.
telling you.
Right. Well, we're going to get you guys back on when the book comes out, and we'll get you guys back on that at a later date to go more in depth on this.
Right.
And Tommy, what were the police doing while this war of treachery was going on?
Well, the way it started off that we don't find out till later is that the Persico faction makes a move to kill Vicarina. So, you know, that's when he realizes there's a problem. He's not really battling for the family at that point. He just spots them trying to kill him. And then, like Larry said, there's a lot of misinformation and a lot of treachery and a lot of people out for their own reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can really put the whole blame on Vic. He was more on the offensive himself and his family than the defensive. I mean, on the defensive more than the offensive. But we just started seeing people getting shot all over the place. And through informants and intelligence information, we found out that there was an internal war. And it really got intense when they killed a kid by the name of Mateo Speranza. He was a 17-year-old boy working in a bagel store, totally innocent. And that's when it really got, you know, intense between the FBI, the NYPD, really putting a lot of pressure on people and making, you know, a lot of car stops and gun arrests. And it was 2 years of craziness.
Right. And Larry, is this where you became a so-called hitman during this war, or did you do?
Yeah, no, I was involved in different things with Greg over the years, but part of the bring up is they take you along in baby steps. You know, you may just know of something, then you may be asked to drop them off somewhere, then they may tell you buy a shovel, then they may tell you dig a hole, you know, and then you sit next to me while I shoot them. Ultimately, yeah, I became a shooter during the war. And, you
wow.
know, we...
So it's almost like being an apprentice carpenter, right?
I mean, well, yeah,
you,
it is.
You just go through a training period, and then you gradually, you know, move up the ranks to more and more responsibility on that. But you make no bones about the fact that you killed people and you testified like this in court. And
right.
some of this conversation, I mean, some of the things you said, like I remember I was reading, I think it was the New York Daily News, and you said something like, I actually saw his facial features splatter in the windshield. It was surreal. And you're talking about Nicholas Granzio. What happened
Black.
There? Pardon?
Well, a few days earlier, Nicky sent a message that to an uncle of mine, Uncle Albert, that he was going to kill me, told my uncle, to kill your nephew Butchie, which was my nickname, if he doesn't come over to our side.
Mm-hmm.
So my uncle got the message to me, and plus we had somebody in Nicky's club, so we heard that firsthand. So we made him target number one. The next day, we were lucky enough to spot him, and we were packed. You know, I had a shotgun on me. Greg had a rifle. Jimmy had a few pistols. We had a walkie-talkie in the windshield and a siren. So we would look like cops, and we pulled up behind them. And, you know, just as he pulled over, we pulled up alongside, and, you know, I just thought about in my head, I said, this guy's going to kill me. Well, I'm not going to wait for that. And, again, being in it and being brought along, I was ready for it, and I shot him, and, I saw his face hit the windshield.
Hey, Ronnie, I got a question.
Before you continue, I was going to ask him a follow-up on that. Well,
yeah.
How do you feel after a hit? You know, you do this and you kill a human being, and what do you do? Is this part of like what they say, part of business, or how did you feel?
Well, most guys and myself, it's not easy to do. There are vicious guys that, like Greg, that it's nothing to them. To me, it was always, I can't even tell you how hard it was. And afterwards, it is. I still have nightmares. I have nightmares that this guy is still alive, and I'm walking down Avenue U, and I see him walking towards me with a hole in his head.
Wow.
No, you know, if you have any humanity and compassion in your life, you never get over that. I mean, I was in a circumstance where it was kill or be killed, and maybe to an extent I'm making excuses, but to an extent I'm not. It was reality. I was going to be killed by this guy. So we
right.
got him first. It's
right.
Yeah.
Right. Willie, go ahead, please.
Yeah, go ahead. This one's for Larry. Larry, in that Godfather movie we talked about earlier, the famous slogan there saying, going to the mattresses, going to the
right.
mattresses. Now, can you describe that? Was that used in your time during this Colombo crime wars?
We didn't call it that, but, yeah, we absolutely lived that life. I was not living home. Neither was Jimmy or Greg. We would be living out in, you know, maybe to Jersey or Long Island somewhere. We'd get apartments. There is truth to that. You know, you travel in teams. I couldn't go anywhere without a bulletproof vest and two carloads of guys around me. And same for Greg and Jimmy. And, you know, so we definitely lived that. We didn't call it going to the mattresses. I don't know if that's a Hollywood thing, but, yeah, we lived that.
Wow. And that, how many hits did you carry out during your, and why can you talk about them, freely today?
I mean, it's all public knowledge now. It's testified about. I mean, by the time I got there to talk about it, Greg had laid out everything that happened. There was four or five guys that testified. So all I really had to do was go up and admit that I did do it, you know, and
right.
that's pretty much what saved my life, along with the corruption, which I won't get into now. I don't know if Bobby or Tommy want me to talk
right,
about
we
that.
Can't, we can't. Yeah, right. We'll
right.
get into
okay.
that another time.
That's a whole other
but,
story, right?
Right. But Tom, while this was going on, did you know that that Larry was involved with this type of activity?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had surveillance photos of him and Jimmy and Greg at wakes, at funerals. They were caught by two detectives on their way out to hunt people down, and Greg threw a gun out the window. And rather than chase the car, they want because they identified who was in it. They grabbed a gun and, you know, got a warrant for Greg's arrest. I mean, I knew Larry was running around, but they were very low key in what they were doing because they were executing what they needed to do and not getting caught with all the
right.
surveillance
I
out
wish
there.
You would have caught me about a year earlier and arrested me. Why didn't you arrest
right.
me then?
Right. But, you know, this wasn't just a mob war. Innocent people got killed too, right?
Yes,
and,
too.
And that put the heat on you guys, the good guys, detectives, NYPD.
That really, I mean, the public wasn't, you know, any time you have bodies dropping all over and front page news that there's a mob war going on in Brooklyn and people are getting shot sometimes, you know, one and then 2 days later again, and there were gun collars left and right. But when the young boy got killed, that really put it over the top, and, you know, we knew that we had to put a stop to it, and the FBI and the NYPD joined forces
right.
and really put a lot of pressure on everybody, and sooner or later, you know, there was one particular guy that cooperated that was the beginning of the end of the war, and the war really didn't end. I mean, it was 91 to 93, but
right.
technically, if you're familiar with the whole story, the last murder of that Colombo War was William Catullo, who was on the Arena side, and he was killed, I believe it was May 26, 1998, and that was really the last
murder. Persico went to jail for that, right? And they went to jail
Yes, Persico went to, they didn't even find the body, and we put
right.
him away with the FBI for life.
Right. Well, you know, I'm a crime historian, and I see this, I study this, and you realize that these wars are futile. Nobody really wins. And I know Bob, you write in that, you know, interesting prologue, you said the Colombia War was really not that much different from past mob battles in that it was a power struggle between the old and the new. I mean, don't these guys read crime history? I mean, don't they learn from the past, Bob?
I'm
talking about the godfathers that make the big decisions.
Yeah, but I think the mob, you know, I'm certainly not a mob expert, but, and I think Larry could actually probably describe this better, but, back in the early 90s, there were a lot of young bucks, and a lot of the wise old guys were incarcerated, they were away, they were retired, and you had a lot of young, wild guys running around that might not have been, you know, had it been a decade or two earlier, maybe it would not have been so violent and you know, as brief as it was, as violent as it was.
Right, on that. Willie, let's take a break, and we'll go into the last segment. Fascinating discussion with our three guests. Go ahead, Willie.
You bet. What a great show tonight. Thanks to the fellas there tonight. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb. Now back to Larry Mazza, Tommy Dades, and Bob Mladenich to talk about the Colombia Mafia Wars.
Right, and we are talking about your books, Tommy and Bob. And are there any websites that our listeners should be aware of that might direct them to some of your works,
Tommy?
As far as the book "Friends of the Family" goes, about the two mob cops, there's a motion picture in the works right now, written by Terry Winters, who did The Sopranos and Boardwalk Empire.
Right.
And that should be coming out late 2012.
Okay.
If you go on the website and pull up Friends of the Family or pull up Mob Over Miami, you know, it'll bring up the history and the story of both cases.
Right. On that. And what about you, Bob?
All of the books are available, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. And I've been getting my latest statements, and apparently they're all selling fairly well now in that Kindle format, which I'm really not all that familiar
right.
with, I hate to admit. But they're obviously they're doing okay there.
Right. To get back to our fascinating discussion, we're talking about the Colombia Mafia War. And we have Larry Mazza, who was a hitman for the Persico side in that war, and we had Tommy Dades, who was a policeman with the NYPD detective and investigated, and he was a friend of Larry's, and Bob Mladenich, who's writing a book about that. What about the the impact of that war. I mean, I said this that nobody really won. And I know that the Columbos had, you know, real problems with the commission, right?
They're
thinking about kicking them out and doing everything. So what happened to the Colombo family after this war?
At this point right now, the Colombo family is totally, I mean, they're out there, but they're really dismantled. They're on the bottom of the barrel like the Bonanno family is. That war was the beginning of the end for them, and it hasn't stopped hitting them up until today. They're still taking guys down from murders back in the 80s and the 90s as a result of people who cooperated that went away or cooperated because of the war. So it wasn't really financially, which is the main reason that the mob exists, it wasn't the best idea in the world.
Right, right. And I guess when you were going through this war, probably one time you're wondering, what the hell are we doing, right? Why are we involved in this war? I mean, you know, when you get into these type of brutal wars of attrition, you tend to lose the purpose of the war, and it becomes just a killing exercise.
It did for us, because at first we had what was called almost like a Cold War, where it was war of words and different nerve things going on, who had more balls in situations. And then, you know, Greg would tell us it's inevitable. We're going to be shooting. This is going to be a shooting war. And you don't believe it. You don't believe it. But then eventually it does become that. And there was times halfway through the war or three quarters through the war, Jimmy and I were so frustrated, we didn't know if we should leave. Mm-hmm. We didn't know if we should. I mean, he would look at me through the mirror, because he was the driver usually, and I was in the back seat.
Right.
Greg was in the front seat. He would look at me, and the things Greg was saying to us, I knew his look to me was, should we just shoot him and end it? I mean, that's how sick this got.
Right.
You know?
Right, wow.
And I even now I hate saying that, because I would never do it, but I never thought I would do the things I did anyway, so who the hell knows?
Right.
But
yeah, Larry, what kind of weapons did you guys use doing that sort of stuff?
Well, we had Tech-9s, we had Uzis, we had shotguns, we had pistols, rifles. When I shot Nikki, I had a shotgun. And we had cutouts in the back seats of some cars where we can hide the weapons in case we got pulled over. We had drops underneath the car where we could drop pistols out the bottom of the car, and it would, you know, fall into a little case in case somebody pulled us over. Mm-hmm. But we had, we had an arsenal in the car with us, a little mini arsenal.
Wow.
And we were all, we had bulletproof vests on. And we had the police scanner, which is a whole other story. I don't know if you want to hear about that.
Oh, explain that briefly, please. Just give the listeners
We wound up getting a police scanner, and we had the frequency that Tommy and his boys were using along with the FBI. So we were actually following them, follow us, watching them follow our enemies. And, you know, we were keeping an eye on them while they were keeping an eye on us. It was crazy.
On that, I know when I was reading Bob's Mladic, his prologue, gives a taste of the book that's forthcoming. Both you, Tommy and Larry, felt betrayed as a result of the Colombo War. Can you maybe explain why you felt betrayed? Tommy first?
I guess with me it had to do with, I had a great relationship with the FBI, worked with some unbelievable agents, basically grabbed a lot of their coattails through a lot of these cases. But when I was working in the Brooklyn DA's office, there was a case, and, they had locked up a detective named Joe Simone during the war for supposedly leaking information. He was acquitted federally but lost his pension. And the Brooklyn DA's office arrested an FBI agent years later. And my end of it, which people still really don't realize, was working on the Joe Simone aspect of it, that he was a fall guy, because there were a lot of inconsistencies in the case. And I just seen a lot of things that went on that were very unfair, and
you know, disturbed me, and I saw a detective's life get ruined, and I saw the FBI turn on me, a group of agents turn on me because I was working in the DA's office and they happened to lock up an FBI agent.
Oh.
And they don't even realize I had nothing to do with the actual probable cause of arresting him. That wasn't what my job was. But I was bad-mouthed and ripped apart. And during the war, I gave them so many different things. I've got letters from the director telling me that I gave them the informant that ended the war. So I got a little bitter towards the end.
And of course, that'll come out in the book, and we'll have you on to talk a little bit more about that in depth. How about you, Larry? I know you served a lengthy federal prison sentence.
I did.
And you know, but you also felt betrayed, according to what I read, the little bit I read in Bob's prologue.
Well, I felt that I was brought into the life by a mob guy that was looked up to by every other mob guy. Later on found out that some of those mob guys knew about him.
Mm-hmm.
He turned me into the consummate good fella. I lived the life the way you're supposed to. He once told me when a good fella walks in a room, they'll smell you. They'll know you're a good fella. I still feel that today. I walk in places and I still feel that little something. But all the while he was teaching me this, he was a government informer. Okay? He was the consummate rat or stool pigeon. Then I go through this war, back to back, shooting, getting shot at, and the top guy, Carmine Sessa, gets pinched. The day he gets pinched, he tells on everybody. Rats on everybody, okay? And this was a trickle thing. I spent a year in prison watching guys way above my head turning week after week after week. Ultimately, I knew I had two ways out of this life, by making a deal with the government or winning the case, going home and getting killed by the Colombo family in retribution for what went on during the war. I had no outs. You know, I'm not, you know, trying to soft coat what I did, but I had no choice. From the cards that they dealt me, I played the hand. And really, that's what it came down to. I feel very, very, stabbed in the back by friends and family. It's amazing. You know, I could go on and on, but
right. Well, we'll give you a chance later day when the book comes out and to talk about that. We're almost out of time here. I just wanted to ask Bob about the book itself. When are you planning to have it done? When we expect this, which is going to be a blockbuster?
Well, I got the book is about 60% done. I'm going to go hide myself away for a month or so, and I got the final 8 chapters all laid out.
Oh, wow.
And all I got to do is kind of fill in the blanks,
right,
and then we're good. We're going to be good to go. Hopefully next year it'll be out.
Gil, keep us informed, because we want you on. And I just want one last question here for Larry and Tommy. Do you guys go out for a beer after the show?
Well, we'll probably be together tomorrow.
Okay, then. Well, have one for us, for Willie and myself, okay?
We will. Thank you so much.
We'll join you in New York City when we come to New York City. And thank you, guys, for your great show.
You,
we really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Okay.
Ron, thank you. Always a pleasure.
Good night.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, gentlemen. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Willie, what do you think of that?
Thanks, fellas. That was great. Pleased to have Larry Mazza, Tommy Dates, and Bob Mladenich on our program tonight. Well, what a great interview. I'm telling you, you know, a mobster, a hitman, a couple of journalists, two ex-cops. Hey, what did you learn about an interview tonight?
Well, I learned that no matter who we have on and no matter how much we think the mafia is finished, it's still the most interesting subject in the world, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, the stories are just endless about the mafia. And we're lucky to have him on, and we'll get him on again, because I saw some topics we could discuss. What about you, Willie?
Well, first of all, we need at least 4 hours with these guys. Anyway, I learned that there should be a movie produced about these deadly events that took place almost two decades ago.
Well, there's going to be one.
Well, I'm telling you, Martin Scorsese is the prime candidate to direct something like this, let me tell you. I can see it now. De Niro, Pesci, Walken, Kilmer, Chapsick, and Harib. Wow, what a cast.
Hey, that's great. That's great. I can hardly wait to get my shot at 15 minutes of fame, Willie.
Yeah. Anyway, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our new segment on Crime Beat. It's a history lesson of sorts. Here it is. You know, Ronnie, not many people know what the Mafia really is and the origins of it. So here we go with a brief history lesson. The Mafia is an international secret society that originated in Sicily and means boldness in Italian. That's boldness. The organization dates back to the 1806-1815 period when, under British pressure, attempts were made to break up the huge estates of the Sicilian feudal aristocracy. Now, in the 1880s, many Sicilians emigrated to the United States, and the Mafia, as Cosa Nostra, which means our business, became established in New York and Chicago. In the 1920s, the fascist government in Italy brought Mafia leaders to trial, but some escaped to the United States, where they became active during the Prohibition era. After World War II, Mafia activities spread worldwide, where they became involved in organized prostitution, fraud, theft, and kidnapping. In the United States, the Mafia is notable for its infiltration of legitimate business, like transportation, construction, gambling, and fast food, and its use of these businesses for money laundering. Heretofore, Ronnie, Mafia members are required to live by a code of silence called Omerta. But times are changing, buddy. Some of the dons are starting to sing like canaries.
Right. So, yeah, up until the end sounded like a outdated encyclopedia entry. You talk about Omerta. You know, that's long gone. But that was a good summary of the origins of the Mafia, which is a good way to end the show. So. Let's move on and out, Willie.
You bet. Well, now, just a reminder for all you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for December the 15th, where we'll have as our special guests Anthony Amore and Tom Mashburg, authors of Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists, and Eric Rasmussen, author of The Shakespeare Thefts, In Search of the First Folios. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar, put it on your BlackBerry, or just stick it on your fridge. You won't miss that one. Now, we hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harim. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. We'd like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. And in the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. If you want to support our broadcast, please make a contribution to Crime Beat via the Artist First World Radio Network. The address is on the top page on the website for your quick reference. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chepsik and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.